99.9% of wrestling fans probably would not recognize, and for good reason. Matt Williams was director of research for WCW. He spent a year of his life polling fans about what they liked and disliked about the company and what they felt should be changed to make it a more enjoyable product. He polled not only fans who were still watching, but fans who had long since given up on the product. The results probably would come as no surprise to anyone. The fans wanted more wrestling and less sports entertainment. When Mr. Williams presented his findings to WCW, you could imagine the response. The entire study was thrown out, since the writers, obviously, couldn't take seriously the thought that their job was overrated and wrestling fans were more interested in watching wrestling. Williams, outraged, quit for a job in another Time Warner division. And so, nothing changed. The end of July, the internal estimates came back and showed that the company had lost $7 million over the course of 1 month. 1 month! Keep in mind that until 1999, the most WCW had lost in an entire year was $6 million. Changes were immediately made. First, almost 24 undercard guys were cut. This was in addition to the 24 or so that had been cut over the past year. Then, discussions about cutting some of the higher-priced guys began, names as big as Hulk Hogan, Goldberg, Lex Luger, DDP, and Bret Hart. The belief was that these guys were being paid too much on their guaranteed deals, and it was killing the company. The stark reality was much different. The company was being killed, and therefore the revenue wasn't coming in to pay off those deals. Not only were the big stars making just as much money 2 years earlier, but they also had 260 guys under contract, some of whom, like Kevin Wackalls and Lanny Poffo, never made one single appearance for the company. Despite this, the company made a huge profit, because they were still making tons and tons of money from house shows, pay-per-views, merchandising, advertising, and so forth. As it turned out, had every single wrestler in the company worked for free in 2000, the company would still have been on track to lose $40 million. Internally, there was another big management shakedown, and when the dust settled, Bischoff was relegated to being a consultant, and Brad Siegel had put all his faith behind Vince Russo. This was a very controversial decision, since many in the company, unlike Siegel, actually had backgrounds in wrestling and saw Russo for the flop that he was. In fact, a week earlier, an internal memo had been passed around detailing the, quote, 10 questions not to ask Vince Russo. Among them were, how many young and hungry employees does it take to screw up an entire company? And what does the second W in WCW stand for? Perhaps as a way to get Goldberg to quit, Russo had a meeting with him on August 2nd and told him the plans were for Kevin Nash to win a three-way over him and Steiner at the August pay-per-view, and then, on the September show, Steiner would pin him. Goldberg was not down with this and walked out. Everyone immediately assumed the whole thing was a work. He was back a week later, but quite unhappy. The August 7 Nitro in Denver featured a Vince Russo interview where he went on and on with his delusional figures about how the company was better off now that he was there and how WWF was in much worse shape. No one was quite sure where he was getting these numbers, since the WWF went from grossing $251.5 million in 1999, to $379.3 million in 2000, the year after Russo had left. However Russo tried to spin things, hard numbers told a different story. Nobody was sure what the point of doing this interview on Nitro was either. And, in quite the coincidence, the show did a horrid 2.44 rating, well below what it was averaging when he first started. The main angle was Goldberg giving Steiner's valet, Medasia, a jackhammer through a table backstage, and Steiner running to her aid. This should have made perfect sense because guys who beat up women are bad, and guys who run to their aid are good. Problem here was that Goldberg was supposed to be the good guy, and Steiner was the bad guy. Thunder the following evening featured announcer Gene Okerlund and Buff Bagwell versus announcer Mark Madden and Canyon in a truly wretched match. If that wasn't bad enough, because Madden was in the ring, someone had to fill in for him. That someone was Judy Bagwell. Apparently the match was supposed to be a shoot, because when Madden gave Gene a low blow, Gene just stood there, causing Tony Schiavone to scream, "Gene didn't sell it!" The big question is, if this was a shoot, why on earth would Canyon have chosen Mark Madden to be his partner? The following Sunday, prior to the New Blood Rising pay-per-view in Vancouver, British Columbia, Siegel called a meeting with the boys to announce that further changes were afoot. The first move was to cut back drastically on production, making Russo irate, since one of his first moves had been to greatly boost the production values, convinced this would make the show more competitive with Raw. To get rid of two of the three big screens, and to ignite less pyro at the beginning of the show, and for the wrestlers' entrances. The biggest change plan was that, effective in late October, they were going to cancel the Thunder tapings and film the show immediately after Nitro on Monday nights. Obviously, the idea was to dramatically cut costs, since the Thunder shows weren't drawing fans. The downside was that nobody was going to Thunder because they did not like Thunder, which meant few were likely to stay after Nitro ended to watch the second show. Some fans, who watched WCW only for its perverse comedy value, anxiously awaited these tapings, since the plan was to film the entire two-show block in 3.5 hours with no commercial breaks. This meant that all the pre-tapes would be done earlier than inserted into the shows. Seeing as to how pre-tapes had often been inserted into Nitro in the wrong order, the thought of the production crew trying to get things right with this new taping plan appeared to be a disaster in the making. New Blood Rising was, of course, a horrible show, not only because the production was drastically cut back, but also because the matches were awful and the angles were atrocious. The fans were so clearly sending a message, but nobody was listening. This was another one of those shows where they sold almost 5,000 tickets very early on, and then, as soon as they started to announce matches on the television programs, ticket sales stopped dead in their tracks. The message, obviously, was that WCW was booking things fans did not want to see. Instead of learning a lesson from this, WCW went on to attempt to force fans to like what they were presenting, and you can imagine how that worked. As if the message wasn't clear enough, it should be noted that almost 3,000 free tickets were snatched up around the Vancouver area. When the day of the show came, only 1,300 of those 3,000 folks actually bothered to show up. Those who showed up left wishing they hadn't. The opener, Young Dragons versus 3 Count, was good. The main event, Booker T versus Jeff Jarrett, was good. Everything else almost set new standards for bad. Ernest Miller pinned Great Muda, in a travesty of justice that Muda, one of the greatest workers of all time, could not save. Bagwell beat Canyon in a below-average Judy Bagwell on a pole match, please don't ask, that despite featuring a run-in by everyone's favorite former WCW champion David Arquette, was actually the third best of the evening. Chronic versus Chuck Palumbo and Sean Stasiak versus Mark Jindrak and Sean O'Hare versus General Rection, Hugh G. Rection was his name, yet another Russo high concept, and Corporal Cajun in a four-way that was overbooked to death. Disco Inferno played heel referee. The finish saw Lieutenant Loco, who was buddies with Hugh G. Rection and Cajun, run down and physically force Disco to count the pin for, yes, Chronic. It probably does not need to be noted that this made zero sense. Kidman beat Shane Douglas in a strap match. Bad. Major Guns beat Miss Hancock, Stacy Keebler, in a women's match. Horrendous. Plus, they teased a miscarriage angle afterwards. That's good family fun. Sting versus Demon. Miserable. Storm versus Awesome for the U.S. title. This was a guaranteed good match because Storm, a Canadian, was super over in Vancouver. Russo, however, showed a tremendous amount of talent by figuring out a way to book the match so that everybody hated it by the end. Jacques Rougeau, another Canadian ex-wrestler, was referee outside the ring. Try to follow this. Awesome pinned Storm with a powerbomb. Storm kicked out and the ref counted three anyway, but in the grand scheme of things, that screw-up could be forgotten. Rougeau said no, according to the Canadian rule book, which they actually printed up and which Storm took home afterwards. You could only win with a five count. Awesome put Storm in a dragon sleeper, and Storm gave up. Rougeau said no, according to the rule book, you couldn't win by submission. Awesome then got a five-count pin after a splash off the top. Rougeau said, after a pin, the loser had 10 seconds to get to his feet, and if he did, the match continued. Storm got to his feet. Both guys went through a table, and this time, the ring announcer said that the first man to his feet at the count of 10 would win. This, of course, made no sense, unless the ring announcer was able to see into the future and predict that one man would, indeed, rise to his feet exactly at the count of 10. Well, Awesome got up first, but Rougeau punched him with brass knuckles behind the other referee's back, allowing Storm to stand up for the win. To say this was hated passionately would be praising it too highly. The only good thing about it was that Bret Hart came out afterwards to a hero's ovation and hugged Storm and Rougeau. Storm recalls, "When the finish was pitched to me, it was pitched in a manner where the office thought all of these restarts would be hilarious, and the match was being booked this way for comedic purposes. The finish was obviously booked to protect Mike and keep him strong, which would have made sense had they not turned him into a comedy act a week or two later when they made him that 70s guy. The way the match was booked was so absurdly stupid, because obviously I was going to be a heavy babyface in Vancouver. I got a monstrous face reaction coming out. The crowd was a sea of Lance Storm signs. So the match was a failure live. They booed every time Mike beat me, and then popped every time Jacques restarted the match. Before the match, Bret even pulled me aside. And keep in mind, this was the first time we'd met in person, and told me that he thought there was a good chance that after getting beaten this many times, the crowd might turn on me. I told him I thought that's why they had him there, figuring no matter how bad they buried me in this match, if Bret Hart came out at the end to endorse me, I would be redeemed in the eyes of Canadians. I got the impression that Bret was reluctant to be a part of this angle, because if the crowd did turn on me, he would be going out there to endorse a loser that had just gotten beaten 3 or 4 times in one match in front of his home crowd. I too was worried this match would bury me to Canadian fans. I thought doing this match in Canada was astronomically stupid, and WCW was passing up their chance to cement a new Canadian star, since Bret's future was in serious doubt after his concussion. This could have been a passing of the torch moment. Thankfully, the crowd stayed with me and even popped when I won. And then, when Bret came out post-match, it was the loudest reaction I've ever heard. Jacques and I had to yell into each other's ear to be heard as Bret made his way to the ring. I suppose I got a little bit of heat in the U.S. out of cheating so many times to keep my title, but to me, it killed most of the credibility I had, making my title run purely a joke. Following the Storm Awesome debacle, Chronic then wrestled again, losing to Vampiro and Mudo in a tag title match. Hideous! Finally, in the coup de grace, Nash beat Goldberg and Steiner to win a shot at Booker T at the next show. This was so bad, it was funny. Nash cut a promo before the match saying that Goldberg was claiming to be hurt due to a motorcycle accident in Sturgis. He really did get in an accident, by the way, but was actually faking the injury and wouldn't come out because of it. They played Goldberg's music twice, and sure enough, he never came out. The match started, and a few minutes later, Goldberg finally appeared. They had a horrible match. Nash went to give Goldberg a powerbomb, but Goldberg dead-weighted him and walked out of the ring. The announcers started screaming about how, this is true, Goldberg wasn't going up for the move and was screwing up the finish. When Goldberg got to the top of the ramp, Russo came out and yelled at him. Goldberg screamed, "Fuck you," and stormed off. The announcers began insinuating that Goldberg was being totally unprofessional and wouldn't do the scripted loss. So Nash and Steiner continued their horrible match. Tony Schiavone, in a direct quote, then said, "If in fact the jackknife powerbomb was part of this design, what are they going to do now? Improvise?" So finally, Nash pinned Steiner with the powerbomb, and the announcers went off about how professional Steiner was for going up for the move. The irony of all of this was that it was supposed to be a shoot, yet not even the dumbest hardcore fan could ever believe that Steiner was this much of a professional. The idea in all of this, which was lost on 99% of the people watching at home, was that Goldberg didn't want to lose two straight shows in a row in real life, so they were going to turn it into a storyline. Of course, in order to do so, they had to pretty much state that all wrestling matches were fake. The concept was lost on WCW, that even though most fans accept that wrestling is not on the level, they want to get lost in the action and suspend their disbelief for the few hours that they watch. It's just like going to the movies. Everyone knows that what they see in the movies is not real, but they're still able to let themselves go for 2 hours and believe what they see up on the screen. Imagine what would happen if during a key scene in a movie like Jurassic Park, there was a technical screw-up and everyone suddenly saw the animated dinosaurs on a computer screen running after rendered versions of the actors. Or, if during a key dramatic moment in another film, both actors just started laughing and said they needed to start over again. Suffice to say, the effect would be ruined. It's the same thing with wrestling. Exposing the secrets of the wrestling business on backstage shows on the WWE Network is one thing, but nobody wants the secrets to be exposed in the middle of a match. Storm recalled a story from that weekend. The week before New Blood Rising, I was contacted by the merchandise people to finalize the Landstorm t-shirt. I asked them if they were going to have them for New Blood Rising because it, as well as Nitro and Thunder that week, was in Canada, and that was obviously the best week to sell Landstorm merchandise. They said, "Absolutely, that's why we were rushing now to get this done." At New Blood Rising, I did an autograph signing thing before the show and had a huge line. I was signing quite a few of these t-shirts, but before too long, a guy came up with a Goldberg shirt for me to sign, and I asked him why not a Lance Storm shirt. He said that's what he wanted, but that they were sold out. I thought, holy shit, I'm sold out already, and got excited about the possibility of my first merchandise check being gigantic, and also hoped they would ship more shirts for Nitro and Thunder. Well, they didn't have any shirts at Nitro or Thunder, and better yet, when I got my merchandise check for t-shirts, I did the calculations, and I had sold a total of 144 shirts. Yes, they brought 12 dozen t-shirts for a 3-show loop through Canada for a guy who held 3 championship belts that he had put Canadian flags on, which had sold out in the first 30 to 45 minutes of the first show. When I asked about why they had made so few, they said, "Well, last time we were in Canada, we didn't sell much merchandise." I asked, "Did you have any Canadians on those shows?" To which they replied, "I don't think so." Nitro the next night was better than the pay-per-view, but that's like saying a gunshot wound to the foot is better than one of the arm. It opened with another wacky shoot segment, in which Russo said Goldberg was going to have to face Tank Abbott, and this time, unlike at the pay-per-view, there was going to be no script. this segment's quarter did a 2.0. Jacques Rougeau, who had been central to the Storm storyline the night before, also quit after this show, since they asked him to do a job for Ernest Miller on Thunder that week. Because he'd started his own promotion in Montreal and had no interest in getting beaten on TV, he'd had it put into his contract that he'd do anything WCW asked except TV jobs. WCW had agreed to this and then attempted to renege on the deal. So he went home. The show as a whole drew a 2.40 rating, which means at this point, it was doing well below what the horrible Kevin Sullivan programs had drawn many months earlier. Also, keep in mind that in order to make up for the ad revenue loss in the move from 3 hours to 2, the show needed to be averaging in the 4.5 range, nearly double what it was doing. Clearly, that wasn't about to happen anytime soon. If it wasn't bad enough that WCW's Saturday Night had recently, without any warning, been turned into a taped show, after 27 consecutive years on TBS, the few fans who were still loyal to it were shocked to find the program off the air that weekend. Done. Finished. No graphic, no farewell message, nothing. Again, this for a show that had been on the network for over a quarter century. More people were also fired that week, including every Mexican in the entire company with the exception of Rey Mysterio Jr. and Juventud Guerrera. This certainly did not help WCW in regards to Sonny Ono's racial discrimination lawsuit. Also axed was Chris Daniels, which was surprising for two reasons. First, he was in his 20s, and the story was that the promotion really wanted to push their younger talent. And second, he was making $75,000 per year, which, in comparison to what some of the dead weight was making and how much the company was losing, was a drop in the hat. By the time the bloodletting was over, they were down to less than 50 wrestlers under contract. That's pretty impressive when you consider they went into the year with 234. A freeze was also put on the hiring of any more new talent. Russo on WCW Live went off on a variety of topics. In particular was his claim that on Nitro as a, quote, total shoot, he was going to offer Bill Goldberg his release from the company. Of course, it was an angle, and the reason everyone knew it was an angle was because Goldberg, who hated WCW and wanted out bad, ripped the release papers up. The whole deal made it impossible to believe anything else Vinnie Roux said in this chat. The August 21 Nitro, despite being a mess of illogical storytelling, had better than usual in-ring action. The problem was that WCW was so uncool at this point that it would have taken months and months of awesome shows to even start turning a corner. As it was, they'd have a good show one week, then a string of horrible ones, then another good one, and so on and so forth. Occasionally, they would have two good shows in a row, and this was so rare that when it happened, it was newsworthy. This show was built around Goldberg and his contract. WCW contracts were a funny thing. They could seemingly not be destroyed. For example, one day Goldberg got mad and ate Scott Hall's contract on TV. Yes, he ate it like it was a taco. Amazingly, the next week on TV, the contract was back looking as pristine as ever. The storyline on this particular Nitro was that Goldberg had a no-cut deal, which was why he was being offered a release. After he ripped up his contract, Russo said if Goldberg laid one hand on him, he would be fired. This, of course, would suggest that Goldberg's contract was not a no-cut deal after all. Then, a few minutes later, Booker T laid several hands on Russo in an unrepentant beating, yet somehow, this did not result in him being fired. The political turmoil of the week involved Kevin Nash, who was lobbying to get the world title from Booker T at the next pay-per-view. His argument was that Booker was not over and that the fans were cheering more loudly for him every week. Truth be told, Booker wasn't getting over like a world champion should. But the reason for that is because he wasn't booked like a top guy, and he was often portrayed as an idiot on television, trusting guys even the dumbest fans knew were going to turn on him, etc. And, in Nash's case, he was getting bigger crowd reactions because he was always pushed harder than almost anyone else But that didn't necessarily mean he was any bigger of a draw than anyone else. The fact is that nobody in the company was drawing any money, and the belt had been destroyed so far beyond hope that it really didn't matter who was wearing it by that point. To show how little folks cared about the Angles in those days, in late August, tickets went on sale for the September 11 Nitro in Charlotte, North Carolina. Since it was Flair Country, the big angle the show was built around was the wedding of David and the supposedly pregnant Stacy Keibler. They sold 700 tickets. On the bright side, when word got out that Rick would be returning on that show, ticket sales surged to 1,657. And after years of screwing the fans countless times, that's what Nitro in Ric Flair Country did as a final number. WCW got some rare good news on Nitro on August 28, doing a 3.52 rating, up quite a bit from the week before. Was the company turning around? Did the improved in-ring action from the week before result in an influx of new viewers? No. Raw was preempted for the Westminster Dog Show. WCW, knowing this was their chance to hit a home run show, threw everything they could muster into an attempt to win fans back. The big angle to end the show had Bret Hart return and meet Goldberg in the desert. Don't ask why they were there or how Goldberg got all the way to the desert within 10 minutes of leaving the Nitro building. Bret said he wanted Goldberg to kill Russo as revenge for what had happened in Montreal. Truth be told, Russo had zero to do with Montreal, and in fact, he had no idea what a double cross was at the time. The swerve, of course, was that Bret was actually mad at Goldberg for ending his career at Starrcade in December with the superkick that nearly knocked his head right off his shoulders. So, he beat him up. You might wonder why this was booked if Bret wasn't going to ever be able to wrestle again and would therefore be unable to have a money match with Goldberg. Or, why Goldberg had initially trusted Bret, who was mysteriously right there in the Las Vegas desert after having been in Canada since January. You'd need to ask Vince Russo. To give an idea of how much of a joke the company became to even their most loyal followers, one Thunder taping in 2000 featured a fan holding up a sign that read, "I'm at a WCW event," while wearing a bag over his head. This wasn't the only sign-related comedy. A man named Peter Goldschmidt sued another man, Robert Cattell, for appearing on WCW telecasts holding up various derogatory signs, including "Peter Goldschmidt, loser for life." Apparently the two used to be friends on Long Island. Then, one day, Cattell asked Goldschmidt to help him move. Goldschmidt supposedly said he was unable to because it was a work day, and the friendship came to a bitter end, leading Cattell to travel around the nation and hold up disparaging signs at wrestling events. The number of lives that WCW ultimately affected is staggering. On August 29, Bischoff resurfaced, flying to Atlanta to talk with Brad Siegel. The hot rumor going around was that he wanted full control of WCW without anyone above him to overrule his decisions. That meant, obviously, that he'd have to purchase the company. He denied it to most everyone who asked. WCW cut even more costs the following week. Some were noticeable on TV, and others were known only to the wrestlers who were quite unhappy about them. For instance, while a few had it written into their contracts that their hotel rooms would be paid for, most did not. Up until this point, it had always happened, but this week, everyone was told they'd have to start forking over the cash for their own rooms. The guys were outraged, which was funny because the WWF wrestlers had been required to pay all their own expenses, including hotel rooms and rental cars, since the beginning of time. The September 4th Nitro from Dallas was built around the trademarked Nitro Swerve, which had been popularized a few weeks earlier. The swerve was that two bad guys would tease turning on each other, but then in the end, they would reveal that they had planned some horrible deed all along. It got to the point where this swerve was done so often that the only way it would have been a real swerve is if the two bad guys really did turn on each other. This week's bad guys in question were Russo and Nash. They teased turning on each other as participants in a triple-tier war games match, but of course, in the end, Russo gave Nash the belt and allowed him to escape. Yes, Russo had possession of the belt right before the finish, which meant, theoretically, he could have made himself the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. You laugh. Soon, you shall cry. The September 11th Nitro emanated from deep in the heart of Ric Flair country. You know, the one where they promised Rick was going to return and still only drew 1,657 paid. The brilliant storyline idea was to have him arrested and taken off the show. The 5 straight minutes of bullshit chants would have taught most wrestling companies a lesson. Not WCW. There was another Nitro swerve, this time with Steiner and Nash. They teased fighting each other, but then turned on babyface ref Booker T and double-teamed him into oblivion. Nobody was sure why the stupid babyfaces never saw things like this coming after witnessing it week after week after week. And of course, there was the David Stacy wedding, which, in a swerve, never took place, as Stacy revealed that David wasn't the father of her unborn baby. By the grace of God, the company went out of business before we had to hear her identify Vinnie Roux as the dad. The show was going very well up until that point, well enough to do a shockingly high 3.2 composite rating to Raw's 5.90. The 3.20 was actually the third good rating in a row for Nitro, mostly because there had been no Raw competition the previous 2 weeks. Unfortunately, it was not a sign of an upward trend. Fall Brawl on September 17 was a surprisingly good show, with the exception of one very scary moment involving 52-year-old Paul Orndorff. Orndorff was a major league wrestling star in the 80s, when the WWF was starting to catch fire nationally. During a run with Hulk Hogan, he suffered a neck injury, but because there was so much money to be made touring, he didn't take any time off. He ended up with severe nerve damage, which caused his left arm to permanently atrophy, and he retired forever for the first time in 1987. In the early 90s, he made a short return for WCW, but was eventually forced to retire again when the injury acted up and he underwent neck surgery. Leading up to Fall Brawl, his main job with the company was as a trainer for their power plant wrestling school. Despite his advanced age and physical limitations, he was still able to stay in tremendous physical condition, so when he was asked to come back for another match, he said, okay. The match was a 14-person tag featuring Orndorff and Disco Inferno and Big Vito and Rey Mysterio Jr. and Juventud Guerrera and Conan and Tigress, a Nitro girl, versus Mark Jindrak and Sean O'Hare and Mike Sanders and Chuck Palumbo and Reno and Johnny the Bull and John Stasiak. Orndorff stayed on the apron for almost the entire match. When he finally tagged in, he attempted to give Jindrak his patented pile driver, but their timing was way off. Basically, when giving a pile driver, the person taking the bump has to jump a bit to allow the person executing it to get them up quickly and easily. Because the timing was off, Orndorff had to muscle him up, and in doing so, he tore his hamstring. In an attempt to compensate, his neck went out, and he collapsed into a state of temporary paralysis. No one in the ring had any idea what to do. So they did the only thing they could think of doing under the circumstances. They kept wrestling. Trainers hit the ring to attend to Orndorff, while the wrestlers attempted to perform outside and on the other end of the ring. Finally, after about 2 minutes of utter confusion, referee Charles Robinson took matters into his own hands and ended the bout. The audience, for once, was well aware that this was a real-life situation and were respectful while he was being worked on. Thankfully, Orndorff ended up being okay afterwards, but he never wrestled another match again. The rest of the show featured far better than usual in-ring action, although there were a couple of horrible bouts. Sting versus Vampiro versus Great Muda springs to mind. The semi-main saw Scott Steiner beat Goldberg in what was actually a tremendous match. Both guys were huge, scary men, and they threw each other around and hit each other really hard, and the fans got very much into the drama. After interference from various people, including Russo and Steiner's valet Medeja, Steiner finally got the win after Goldberg passed out in a submission hold. It was by far the best match either man had been involved in all year and the best of Goldberg's career up to that point. Most impressive of all was that Goldberg hurt his shoulder minutes into the match and was still able to gut out a tremendous performance. Sadly, that wasn't the final match, as Booker T beat Nash in a boring cage match to close out the show. On the bright side, at least Booker got a chance to pin a main eventer clean with his Uranage finishing move for once. Nitro on September 18 took place in Canada. The reason that this is important is because Canada is the home of some very rabid and loyal wrestling fans, and they don't care who they're supposed to cheer or boo. They just do whatever the hell they want. As a result, the crowd reactions on this show were all over the place. Goldberg, who was supposed to be a babyface, was booed mightily, since the Canadians hated anyone who had feuded with Bret Hart and played a role in ending his career. Heels like Russo and Scott Steiner were cheered, the former because he ran down Goldberg, and the latter because he beat Goldberg the night before. And all the reactions weren't necessarily related to Big Bill. The fans cheered heel Jeff Jarrett and booed babyface Booker T. The main angle on the show was another one of those WCW specials. It was Booker and Sting versus Jarrett and Steiner, with the winner getting a title shot the following week. You'll never guess which of the four men won. You would never guess even if you were given four tries, because none of them were the victor. The victor managed to be Russo, who wasn't even in the match at all. All of this set up a day that will live in infamy, the September 25 Nitro from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. See if you can put two and two together before you finish reading about what happened. Vince Russo, creative goof and number one contender to the world title. His hometown. Perhaps that was too much information. Midway through the show, literally with no warning whatsoever, they had a Goldberg versus Steiner cage match. Keep in mind, their previous match was an awesome dramatic affair, so theoretically, they should have been able to draw a bit of money on pay-per-view by locking the two inside a cage. Instead, not only did they give it away for free on Nitro, but they gave it away for free with no warning whatsoever. Long story short, they made $0 on pay-per-view to draw a 2.17 quarter. Yay, WCW! The main event saw Russo get his title shot against Booker T in a cage. It should be noted that Russo was so popular in his hometown that when they announced on Nitro that he'd be getting a title shot here, approximately 200 additional tickets were sold that whole week. The rules of this match were that you could win by pinning your opponent, making him submit, or leaving the cage. 100 million men ran in, including Goldberg. We note that it sort of kills the entire concept of a cage match when folks can just walk in and out at will, but WCW had already been doing this for years. Finally, Booker moved to escape, but just as he was about to set foot on the floor and retain his belt, Goldberg speared Russo so hard that Russo went through the side of the cage and crashed into the guardrail. The guardrail, of course, was outside, which meant, oh yes, Vince Russo was the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. Years later, no less than Jim Herd would have this to say about Vince Russo, WCW Champion. Vince Russo was a guy who thought in his own mind only that he was a draw. Give me a break. You know what makes us most sad about WCW dying? The fact that we never got to see an on-air team-up of Russo and Herd. That would have been spectacular. The only good thing about this entire situation was that the visual of Goldberg spearing Russo through the cage was really awesome. Goldberg shared that opinion himself. WCW. The downfall's name was Vince Russo. The only entertaining part of his time there was getting to spear him and having his head hit the post. Before I got in the ring, his helmet fell off, and I wasn't going to step foot in that ring until he had it back on because I didn't want him to sue me for killing him. Booking-wise, this was the final nail in the coffin that housed the WCW World Heavyweight Championship, a belt that, in storyline at least, dated back to 1905. Its days of drawing money were over. Well, they were over more than ever. But, storyline stuff aside, there was something else that could have ended up in a coffin. Russo. Vinnie Roux had been getting involved in a lot of matches over the previous few months, and suffice to say, he was no athlete. He was certainly nothing resembling a pro wrestler. Although wrestling is predetermined, fake, the fact of the matter is that when an untrained layperson gets injured, he is setting himself up for some serious injury. The human body does not like the idea of falling flat on its back, and learning to do so takes time, sometimes several months. If you land with your weight too low, your head can snap back and bounce off the ring, which, contrary to popular belief, is made of steel and wood, and in absolutely no way resembles a trampoline. Russo had suffered various injuries during his bouts, including a number of concussions. There was a reason that he wore a helmet to the ring when wrestling his later matches, and it wasn't strictly for comedy purposes. His brain was swollen, and like with all concussions, once you suffer one, the likelihood of suffering another increases immensely. Bret Hart knew this firsthand. His career ended for that exact reason. You can say whatever you wish about Vince Russo as a writer and booker for World Championship Wrestling, but in real life, he was a human being with a family, and going into the ring after having suffered multiple concussions was putting his health and his life in jeopardy. It was sad to see him doing so, especially in light of the Paul Orndorff, Bret Hart, and Darren Drozdov situations, all of which occurred that very same year. And what did he get for risking his livelihood? Nitro did a 2.87 to Raw's 5.44. Believe it or not, a lot of people were thinking that Nitro was going to win that evening. The reason for that is that after 17 years on the USA Network, the WWF moved to TNN. TNN at the time was the Nashville network, and the belief was, seriously, that fans weren't going to be able to find Raw after it switched. Now keep in mind that it was still airing Monday nights at 9 p.m., and that all fans would have to do was run through all the channels, and if their cable service had TNN, at some point they were going to find it. This did not matter to many. They were sure the WWF was done for. They were wrong. The only thing that was done for was ECW's weekly TNN show, which was scheduled to be canceled on September 22nd due to McMahon's Viacom contract stating that his shows could be the only wrestling programming on the network. Vince, however, being the benevolent evil billionaire that he was at the time, mercifully allowed them to stay on by waiving the clause. Ultimately, it didn't matter, because he eventually signed ECW owner Paul Heyman to a contract, and the company, which was going to die no matter what because it just didn't have the assets to compete, closed up shop shortly thereafter. In late September, the WCW booking situation was finally cleared up by Kevin Nash in a radio interview. He said he was never really in charge of booking, because all of his great ideas ended up being shot down by Hogan and Bischoff. What was funny about this was that Hogan always told his friends that he never changed any ideas, he just did what he was told and let Bischoff and Nash run it. And you'll never guess what Eric always told people. He never gave any input, instead putting full booking power in Nash's hands so he could sink or swim. Apparently, a mystery man was writing all of the shows. In early October, the first serious rumors of WCW being sold began making the rounds. There had been plenty of talk in the past that Time Warner might be interested in selling, and that Bischoff was doing whatever he could to get investors together to make an offer. There were even rumors that offers had been made, but both sides were far apart on numbers. In fact, in the summer of 1999, Mandalay Bay Sports and Entertainment had registered the WCWExtreme.com and WCWXtreme.com domain names. This, however, was the first time that anyone was mentioning what they believed was a real time and place. October 23rd in Little Rock, Arkansas, the first Nitro back after the Australian tour. The story was that Bischoff and Mandalay were teaming up to make a purchase. As it turned out, the day came and went, and no sale was announced. On the October 2nd Nitro in San Francisco, WCW World Heavyweight Champion Vince Russo announced that he was vacating the title, meaning that not only did he win the belt, but nobody ever would beat him for it. He had two other major announcements. First, he wasn't going to fire Goldberg for spearing him out of the cage last week. Instead, Goldberg had to win 176 matches in a row to get a title shot, and if he lost even one, he'd be fired. Many of the fans who'd lived through the Sid win streak strongly suspected that this might not be on the level. Russo also announced a Jarrett and Booker versus Steiner and Sting tag match, with the two winners squaring off for the vacant belt in the main event. Jarrett and Booker won the match, and the two squared off in yet another Russo classic. The world's first ever San Francisco 49ers match. Basically, there were four boxes hanging from the poles. Inside one of the boxes was a belt. Inside the other three were, well, not the belt. Whoever got the box with the belt in it would be the champion. If Frank A. Gotch didn't turn in his grave after watching the Nassau Coliseum show, he surely did after this. The first box opened contained a blow-up doll. The second contained a photo of Scott Hall, who hadn't been seen in as long as anyone could remember, but was still way more popular than 95% of the active roster. The third box contained a glove that you would use for, say, gardening, but it was identified as a coal miner's glove. The finish saw a midget named Beetlejuice from the Howard Stern show give Jarrett a low blow, allowing Booker to open the last box. Unfortunately, the belt fell out of the box before he was able to get it, so ring announcer Dave Penzer had to pick it up off the floor and hand it to Booker for the win. Of course, following the rules to the letter, this should have meant that Dave Penzer was the new WCW World Heavyweight Champion, but thankfully Russo wasn't fast enough on his feet to change everything around at the last second. 1 week after Russo's steel cage stunt match, Bill DeMott, Captain Rection, did an interview with Alex Marvez and revealed that he had suffered 6 concussions in 3 weeks and had been advised by his doctor to quit wrestling. You see, the injuries had caused legitimate brain damage and simple tasks, like reading street signs and even standing for long periods of time, had become extremely difficult. He was making good money, though, so he vowed to wrestle at least one more year before retiring. Rumors of the company's, quote, impending sale grew hotter as October wore on. In fact, things got so out of control that Brad Siegel told Terry Taylor to meet with the boys on October 8 to discuss it. Taylor basically said that 4 companies were interested in purchasing WCW. In addition to Bischoff's group, there were 3 others in Japan, France, and Germany. None of the latter 3 were specified, although months earlier, rumors had spread that one of Japan's major wrestling organizations, either New Japan, All Japan, or NOAH, was interested in buying, though it was never clear which. Taylor said there was no guarantee the company would be sold, but they were entertaining various offers. Another name that popped up that week as a possible buyer was Vince McMahon. The instigator of this rumor was Antonio Inoki of New Japan, who had a history of making up outlandish tales. Whether he knew more than he let on or not, the fact was that McMahon was interested. Soon, multi-channel news was reporting, through unnamed sources, that the WWF had the right to match any offer for the company as a result of settlement terms of their copyright infringement lawsuit. Both that lawsuit and WCW's countersuit have been quietly settled out of court in September. Since the details were sealed, Nobody knew for sure whether or not this was true, but as the weeks wore on, it was believed to have been a false story. WWF lawyers even publicly denied it. Regardless, McMahon had serious interest, and talks between the two companies continued for many weeks. By the end of 2000, however, it appeared that McMahon decided to pass on the deal entirely. In the midst of all these sales talks came what should have been a highly successful tour of Australia. Tickets had been going like gangbusters since mid-July, and this looked to be WCW's most successful house show run of the year. Almost immediately, however, things went wrong. Juventud Guerrera, apparently in a drug-induced fit, caused a huge scene at the Brisbane Marriott Hotel. The previous night, at a club, he'd smoked something given to him by an unknown person, and the authorities suspected it had been laced with PCP. He went to bed, and the following morning he went insane near the hotel restaurant where all the wrestlers were eating, tearing his clothes off while screaming that he was going to kill himself. Several wrestlers, nearly all of them much larger than Guerrera, tried to subdue him to no avail. Cops showed up with pepper spray. Finally, he was tackled, handcuffed, and escorted from the building. Between fines and compensation to several officers he attacked, he was ordered to pay $1,850 U.S. He was also lucky enough to not have a conviction placed on his record, because as a Mexican citizen who traveled internationally, that would have seriously impacted his career. A WCW spokesman, speaking to a local newspaper, said that Hoovy's behavior was, among other things, unexpected. So apparently him taking off all of his clothes and going insane in a drug-induced rampage was not on the itinerary for that day. WCW was so outraged by Hoovy's behavior that they promptly fired Scott Hall, who, as you might recall, went crazy on an overseas tour back in February. As you also might recall, he thought he could never be fired because of the trademark infringement lawsuit, and, as coincidence would have it, that lawsuit had been settled a month earlier. And yes, Hoovy was canned too. WCW never bothered to tell him initially, though, and he wasn't aware of it until a bunch of friends called and told him that they had read about it on the internet. There wasn't much to the Australian shows in terms of content, but, as expected, they all did tremendously well business-wise. In fact, every show drew at least 9,000 paid, and even Thunder completely sold out. Of course, since this was WCW, they actually managed to lose money on the tour. Apparently, the company had signed a contract with the Australian promoters saying they'd buy back any unused seats at the shows. Unfortunately, this included seats that could not be sold due to the TV production equipment. Because they ran four shows taped for TV, the faux pas resulted in WCW losing $400,000 on a tour that should otherwise have been profitable. And so back to America the company came, and as usual, they brought their crappy shows with them. The October 5th Nitro was one of those horrible shows where everything that could possibly go wrong did. It was supposed to be pushed back a half hour due to a NASCAR race. In the past, WCW had often forgotten to alert viewers that their programming was being moved to a different time or even to a different day, but this time, they made it very clear that the show was starting at 8:35 p.m. Unfortunately, when fans tuned in at 8:35 p.m., the show had already been on for a half hour, since the program hadn't been preempted after all. There were a bunch of hideous matches, including Wall versus Jim Duggan, a match so horrible it made one long for a Vince Russo WCW title defense. The Young Dragons, three great cruiserweight wrestlers, were all squashed at the same time by Scott Steiner, putting a damper on the whole idea to push the cruiserweight division. Lex Luger, in an interview segment with Stevie Ray called Sucka's Gots to Know, asked if what he was about to say was just between the two of them. Apparently, he was unaware that the program was being broadcast nationwide to several million people. Stevie was apparently unaware as well, since he responded that it was, quote, just between you, me, and 5,000 viewers. Yes, 5,000 viewers. Tony Schiavone tried to make the save by claiming, really, that he meant 5,000 viewers in each house. The following week, Russo cited brain damage, post-concussion syndrome to be exact, as his reason for temporarily removing himself from the creative process. Even though he had stayed in the U.S. and faxed all of his storyline ideas to Australia for that series of shows, he suddenly announced that he would not be able to do his job anymore since his doctors had banned him from leaving the house until November 16th. Some theorized that his fax machine must have broke. While it was unfortunate that Russo had a concussion, at least he got to keep his job. Bret Hart was not so lucky, as on October 20th, he was released. The termination notice came literally days after he received another letter that said he had been re-signed for 2 more years. It was a business decision, as he hadn't wrestled since January due to the head injuries that resulted in him suffering 10% brain damage, and he was theoretically the second highest paid wrestler in the company behind Hogan, pulling in roughly $25,000 a week while injured. At this point in time, Brad Siegel wrote in his termination letter, "We have been unable to utilize your wrestling services for over 9 months, and according to your doctor, you remain incapacitated. Based on your ongoing incapacity, WCW is exercising its right under paragraph 8E to terminate your independent contractor agreement effective Friday, October 20, 2000. Your contributions to the wrestling business are highly regarded, and we wish you only the best in the future." While it was thought Bret would never wrestle again, he did actually come back to WWE for a, quote, match with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania. We put match in quotes because, honestly, it wasn't much of one, just a one-sided beating that was designed to make Vince a sympathetic babyface. Amazingly, the crowd did not agree that Vince McMahon was, in any way, shape, or form, a sympathetic babyface. We should also note that despite not taking any bumps or shots to the head, Bret still managed to win and lose the U.S. title. On October 23rd, WCW did their first double Nitro/Thunder taping. It could have been worse. Surprisingly, the Thunder show was much better than Nitro, which featured all sorts of insanity, not limited to Kevin Nash doing 2 interviews revolving around the fired Scott Hall. You could cut WCW some slack due to the fact that Hall wasn't scripted to be mentioned. But then again, you could cut them no slack for not disciplining Nash in any way, not to mention letting him do the same thing again on the same show a little bit later. Main event saw Scott Steiner beat Mike Awesome in a good match. This didn't prevent the show from doing a 2.22 rating, its lowest non-taped number in years. Thunder main was Goldberg and Sting and Booker T beating Jarrett and Chronic when Sting pinned Jarrett. The original plan was for the bad guys to win. But then, and you may find this impossible to believe, someone remembered that if Goldberg lost, he had to retire. So, instead of just ignoring that like they did with Sid so many times, they actually changed the finish. Ironically, Goldberg, like Sid, magically went from being 7-0 to 12-0 between Thunder and Nitro, despite having not wrestled any matches in the interim. This all led to Halloween Havoc 2000, an event high in the running for the worst pay-per-view of that year. Russo had gone home again, this time citing stress and post-concussion syndrome, and the interim bookers, Ed Ferrara and Bill Banks, were told to keep his current storylines going. Imagine being told such a thing. The best match on the show was the opener, which saw Mark Jindrak and Sean O'Hare beat Rey Mysterio Jr. and Billy Kidman, and Disco Inferno and Alex Wright to retain the tag team titles. It was all downhill from there. Mike Awesome beat Vampiro in a match that was not only horrible, but resulted in Vampiro suffering a serious head injury. Vamp, who after zero training became a main eventer in Mexico in his very first week of wrestling, never learned how to take a real flat back bump until coming to the U.S. years later. The finish was supposed to be him taking a powerbomb off the top rope through a table. This is actually a lot less dangerous than it sounds, because when you go through a table, the table breaks your fall, and it's an easier bump. Their table, however, got broken early, so Vamp had to take the powerbomb from the top rope down into the ring, a much harder landing. His head bounced super hard off the canvas, and he suffered a legitimate concussion. To make matters worse, he was asked to take a second power